Bienvenidos. Este episodio es realmente emocionante. Vamos a estar discutiendo los resultados del estudio Bestiae Basil 2 sobre revascularización infraproplítea. Y sobre todo estamos sumamente emocionados porque tenemos como invitado al doctor Athanasios Tsaratsis, cirujano vascular de la Universidad de Leicester. Él es coautor de Basil 2 y estará compartiendo sus conocimientos y su experiencia sobre este tema y sobre la revascularización infraproplítea. Preparamos un guión que nos parece interesante e intentaremos hacer algunas preguntas que no han sido discutidas en otras de las entrevistas para dar algo de información diferente a lo que hemos podido ya escuchar sobre los resultados de este estudio y enfocarnos un poco no solamente al estudio, sino también a lo que es la revascularización infraproplítea en general. Y para este episodio tenemos de co-anfitrión a un gran amigo. Le quiero hacer público el agradecimiento porque no solamente fue quien hizo la propuesta de hacer este episodio, sino también quien pudo invitar a nuestro invitado el día de hoy, el doctor Gabriel López Peña, quien está haciendo un fellowship en Leicester, en Inglaterra. Él es egresado del Instituto Nacional de Ciencias Médicas y Nutrición Salvador Subirán como angiólogo en México y ya después se fue para allá. Así que, pues muchas gracias, Gabriel, y bienvenido a este espacio.
Hola, Rodrigo. Buenas tardes acá, buenos días allá. Muchas gracias por hacer esto posible. Con mucho gusto. Esperemos que sea de provecho para todo tu auditorio. Y I want to thank Thanos, which I can call a friend. We have the honor to have you today. Thank you very much, Thanos.
Thank you both for the invitation. And I'll hope I'll be able to answer your questions.
Vamos a cambiar entonces ahorita de español a inglés, así que pues esperemos que nos perdonen todas las faltas gramaticales, pero empezaremos entonces ya la entrevista en inglés. So we're going to start in English now, doctor, and I want to start talking about CLTI. We all know that it's a potentially deadly condition and it affects primarily chronic ill patients. And we live in a country where it has one of the highest rates on diabetes and chronic renal disease. So we face a lot of medial arterial calcification in our practice. And it's one of the most common scenarios for Mexican vascular surgeons. So infraproplitial sector, it's one of the most interest to our listeners. And we haven't been able to develop proper recommendations for the treatment of this segment. So we are very excited to speak with you, Dr. Tsaratsis, about answering the big question. Should the infraproplitial segment be approached surgically using a vein bypass or by a best endovascular strategy? So I want to welcome Dr. Athanasios Tsaratsis and thank you for joining us and having you here.
Great stuff. Thank you both very much for the invite.
Thank you very much, Thanos and Rodrigo. Something that you want to start with, Thanos, about all this between Basil II and Best CLI, what is infraproplitial in here in the UK and in your experience?
Yes, the one thing that I would actually like to make sure I do not forget, and I think Rodrigo just mentioned it, we see loads and loads more people with CLTI, and that's an international thing. It's not just Mexico. It's not just the UK. It happens everywhere. But Rodrigo said that we're not very sure how our teams should best manage these patients. And I think that's spot on, because these patients are best managed by teams. And the other thing that Rodrigo said is that our team has produced some new evidence surrounding infraproplitial revascularization and CLTI. So both patient management and evidence generation in CLTI is a team game. It's not just the one surgeon or the one radiologist producing evidence, and it's not just the one surgeon or radiologist or nurse doing revascularization to save someone's leg or life. I think the best way to manage those people is to work as a team together.
Can you share some of the experience on how was it to be involved in this paper?
So first of all, with regards to Basel II, it's been going on for quite some time now. I think I recruited the first patient in Leicester back in 2015 or 2014 when I was a trainee vascular surgeon. The study is led by the Birmingham Clinical Trials Unit, which is based in the United Kingdom, and the chief investigator is Professor Andrew Bradbury. So, as I said earlier, this is a big study. It was a complex study to deliver, and we did struggle with recruitment. And hence, I'm very pro teamwork and collaboration when we are trying to design and deliver those pretty complicated studies. So for me, the experience was quite negative at some point because we were not meeting our recruitment targets, and that had to do with a number of different issues. But I think at some point during this process, we all realized that it was teamwork that would get the study delivered. We opened in more sites. Professor Bradbury was instrumental in trying to open the study outside the United Kingdom as well. And with support from people like myself, I was doing the work on the ground, finding the patients and following them up, as well as the research nurses and the other doctors involved. We managed to pull it through.
We're not trying to make this episode an attempt to compare best CLI with Basel II. However, if we examine some of the differences between the studies, I think that will help us understand scenarios in which the vascular surgeon must choose between two strategies that can improve quality of life in CLTI patients. And the excitement and the pressure for you. So how did you manage to cope with the expectation, especially after seeing the results of Best CLI just a few months before Basel II?
Best CLI and Basel II are two completely different trials. If you look at any randomized control trial, there's the so-called PICO element to it. So you've got a certain population, that's the P, an intervention. That's the I, C, which stands for comparator, and then O, which stands for outcomes. The only common parameter there to a certain degree was the population which both studies recruited. So they were adult patients with chronic limb-threatening ischemia. However, even there are some differences between the two studies. For Best CLI, you've got patients predominantly with SFA and popliteal disease. And then for Basel II, you've got exclusively infrapopliteal disease patients. The other element that was very different were the interventions that were used in the studies. I understand that in a very simplistic way, we're looking at these as endovascular versus open surgery studies. But actually, when you start looking at the supplements in both papers, especially the Best CLI paper, you can see that there's very considerable heterogeneity when it comes to the types of surgery and mostly the types of endovascular therapy that was offered to those people. I would say that the Best CLI trial in a way is very similar to the original Basel trial from about 20 years ago. And then you've got the Basel II trial, which is looking at CLTI patients with infrapopliteal disease. The main intervention tested from an endovascular point of view was plain balloon angioplasty, and the bypasses were almost exclusively venous bypasses in the form of a femoral distal bypass, with not very many pop distal bypasses. So in a nutshell, we're looking at two very different studies, and I don't think that when you take that into account, anyone was expecting to see identical results. When you take the noise out, and when I say noise, I mean the heterogeneity, and that will probably be possible by doing a meta-analysis of the two studies using individual patient-level data, I think that's when we might get some clearer answers.
So people are trying to say, well, best CLIs is better, partial to less patients. So they're trying to actually antagonize between the trials. And as you explained, probably they're actually looking for different objectives. What do you think, or what is your point of view about the outcomes that you measure in BACIL 1, BACIL 2 compared to the best CLI, whether, mortality as the first or primary outcome, and then MALE as a secondary outcome?
Yeah, I just left a patient meeting a few minutes ago where we were trying to understand what the best outcomes are for a future randomized trial that we're trying to design. I'm the wrong person to ask with regards to what the right outcome measure is. The right outcome measures for any trial should be dictated by patients. Again, the outcome measures between those two studies were very different. Best CLI used MALE, where you've got three different elements: amputation, and that's major amputation above the ankle joint, survival, so did the patient die or not, and then major reintervention, however that is defined. Well, I'm not very sure how relevant major reintervention is for a patient. Certain patients think of reinterventions as something really bad, then you've got some other patients who have got different thoughts. So those differences in the outcome measures have to be taken with a pinch of salt. And when you've got a patient in front of you as a clinician, you need to understand what is actually best for that patient in terms of what kind of outcomes are these patients expecting when you're offering some form of treatment to them. For a 92-year-old patient, reinterventions probably don't matter very much. It's probably amputation that would matter to them because they want to maintain a certain degree of autonomy for the next few months of their life. But for a 55-year-old patient, then reinterventions do matter. So we have to understand those differences between certain patients and take them into account when we interpret the results of those studies.
I'm going to seize this moment of you talking about reintervention, because this is one of the questions that we planned for the episode. And despite having a higher reintervention rate, best endovascular strategy in BACIL 2 shown to be less fatal and provided patients with more amputation-free time. So does reintervention should actually matter if we have a procedure that is less fatal and that gives more time with avoiding amputation and more quality of life?
Yeah, that's spot on. Again, in a nutshell, that's what the BACIL 2 study has shown, and that's a very clear interpretation of the finding. Albeit, for certain patients like those who have already undergone an endovascular procedure and that procedure has failed, is another endovascular procedure still the best way forward, or do they now need a bypass? That's probably a subgroup where BACIL 2 has not really given us an answer. And you always have to take into account the patients that were recruited in each study and where the study took place. Most of the patients that were recruited in BACIL 2 received treatment in major vascular centers where the radiologists or the endovascular surgeons doing the treatments were quite experienced. So again, I don't really know whether we can have a blanket policy or some form of blanket interpretation of the BACIL 2 findings that would apply to every single setting and every single patient. As I said, take all of these things with a pinch of salt and try and use the data and interpret the data for a patient, for the patient who's in front of you, as well as the environment around that patient. What kind of expertise is available in your unit? What kind of interventions have these patients had before? But again, I couldn't agree more with you that, I don't know, sometimes I'm not very convinced whether reintervention is something that should be included in a primary outcome measure. Again, that's something to be discussed with the patients. Probably me, I'm not the very best person to answer that question.
Yeah, I mean, I heard before that once you go to the pathway for angioplasty, then you discuss with the patient, well, you probably need to have something else done a couple of months, a couple of years, and that's a pathway you choose to go for the endovascular option. Another issue that we found in both of the studies, and I think, I mean, Tana, you've been involved in a lot of RCTs in CLTI, the recruitment process is quite complicated to get the patients for CLTI RCTs. Also about the power of the population, that because it's been a lot of discussion about that on the power quoting for Basel II.
Yes, absolutely. With regards to power, let's just stop that conversation there. The Basel II trial is adequately powered to look at this specific primary outcome measure. So the hazard ratio that you're getting is a hazard ratio that is most definitely something that you can use in your daily practice with 95% confidence. So the study was definitely powered for amputation-free survival based on the assumptions that Professor Bradbury and the team made when they were applying for funding. Just by looking at the number of patients recruited in the study, you cannot say whether this study had more power or less power. That's just methodologically not right. Okay, so the Basel II study is an excellent, well-conducted study, and it's definitely powered to look at this primary outcome measure with 95% confidence. So is the best CLI study. In fact, when you start looking into the details of the best CLI study, and there's been quite a lot of conversation from our American colleagues on Twitter with regards to differences in power, the best CLI trial was stopped early. So is it not powered to look at whatever primary outcome measures the best CLI investigators were trying to assess? No, it is actually powered to look at those outcome measures. So both studies are well designed and sufficiently powered. With regards to your second question, which was the recruitment process, there's simply no randomized control trial out there that could be extrapolated to the general population with 100% confidence. You cannot expect every single patient to take part in a randomized control trial. Not everyone will consent to it. And then, especially in high-risk populations like CLTI, you will lose certain patients to follow up because of the fact that they've got all those comorbidities, they're more likely to be socioeconomically deprived, etc. The final thing is these conversations about trials not reflecting real-world patients in inverted commas, they tend to take place in conferences or podcasts like this, where most of the attendees have not really recruited anyone in a randomized controlled trial or have not really pushed the agenda with regards to recruiting patients into randomized controlled trials. So the people that have got all those major concerns about RCTs not reflecting our everyday care, the very best thing that we can do is try and ensure that every single CLTI patient who comes across our secondary or primary care practice gets the chance to say whether they would or would not like to take part in a randomized controlled trial. So please open your sites to recruitment and try as much as you can to recruit more patients into these studies. We wouldn't be having these conversations if we were putting all of this effort into recruiting and opening more trials. I hope that covers your question.
But it is also something that happens outside of clinical trials, isn't it? I mean, to follow up a CLTI patient in a daily practice is often difficult. Is it the same for you?
Absolutely. It is very difficult because of several different reasons. As I mentioned, socioeconomic deprivation is one of those reasons. Many times we find that they can't pay for the bus or a taxi to come to follow up. You can find ways around it. You can ring people. You can email them. You can use certain innovations like mobile phones and apps. But indeed, it is very, very difficult to follow up these patients, especially when you're looking for more data, like more blood tests, etc., if you're doing some form of trial.
When looking at the results of BASIL2, especially in the primary objectives, we see that both strategies had comparable amputation rates, while vein bypass had higher mortality rate. Both strategies improved quality of life, yes, but the endovascular strategy had higher amputation survival rates.
Yeah.
So when looking at these results, should death from any cause be sufficient to justify revascularization or to choose the strategy?
So you're practically asking me, why are patients who are undergoing a bypass dying more often? The first thing that I would like to point out is that this is not just happening during the first few days or hours after the procedures, because all of us here would expect that if we take a patient through a 5-hour or a 3-hour bypass, well, obviously they're more likely to die, all right, compared to a 45-minute or 2-hour angioplasty. The patients are actually dying in a consistent rate during follow-up in the BASIL2 trial. And that's still a bit of a mystery as to why it's happening. At the same time, though, I suppose if these patients undergo this major procedure, well, they will be deconditioned, won't they? And they'll be deconditioned for quite a long period of time. But let's look at the open aneurysm population. When you perform an open aneurysm repair on someone at the age of 70 or 80, you don't expect them to return back to their previous life within the space of a few days or weeks. It will probably take something like 9 months to a year for them to get back to where they were before. Now, you're looking at a CLTI population now, not just someone with an aneurysm. And those people who have got CLTI, invariably, they'll have pretty severe heart disease. They're probably smokers. They're more elderly and far more frail than the aneurysm population. So if we subject them to an open procedure, I guess what we're seeing here is the fact that they do not return to their prior state until very late in the process. And hence, we're getting this signal of more deaths. And that's most definitely something that needs to be discussed with your patient if you are about to subject them to a femdistal bypass.
Thank you.
Just to have a bit of background in terms of your experience and practice, Thanos, I mean, I work with you, but what is your approach to crural disease and popliteal disease? Do you still know how to do a bypass, or do you just go endovascular all the time?
I am a vascular surgeon, so I will sit down with a patient, have an honest conversation about the risks and benefits of either a bypass or an endovascular procedure. And based on what I know what to do better and what's available within my immediate environment, we will make a decision about the revascularization. So what do I mean by that? If I haven't got access to decent imaging, the right kind of wires, balloons, etc., I'm obviously not going to offer that patient an endovascular procedure if it is a suboptimal procedure. Similarly, if I've got a patient in front of me who's very frail and cannot survive a bypass following a consultation with an anesthetist and a geriatrician, well, I'm not going to offer them a bypass. This is why artificial intelligence is never really going to replace the doctor to patient interaction. This is a very tailor-made approach based on your expertise, the patient, and the environment where the patient is receiving treatment. Finally, I offer both procedures to patients that need them. And I think you know my preference for endovascular treatments, but I would say that even for endovascular treatments, these are not simple angioplasties. Your endovascular treatment needs to be perfect. Otherwise, it's the wrong procedure for that patient. If you need to go retrograde, if you need to use expensive equipment, which you think is going to make that procedure last longer, well, yeah, you need to get on and do that kind of thing.
Do you analyze the inframalleolar circulation? Do you use a toe pressure or pedal acceleration time in order to decide who goes to bypass and who goes to endovascular?
We measure toe pressures in pretty much everyone who's got CLTI in our unit as a measure of baseline and then perfusion and then a measure of what's happened to their perfusion post-op. Now, is that part of my decision-making in terms of whether I offer them an endovascular procedure or an open procedure? Not really. What does make me decide whether I need to offer my patient or whether I've got a preference for an open operation is the patient in front of me. Are they very frail, etc.? And whether they've had failed endovascular procedures before. So for me, these are the two main things, rather than other weird markers of perfusion to the foot. And finally, when I'm doing an endovascular reconstruction, I will open as many arteries to the foot as possible. But if the patient cannot take a 3 or 4 hour revascularization, then I will be pragmatic about it.
Thank you very much for that, Panos. I just have last couple of questions from my side. One about the trials. You mentioned about probably it's going to be worth it to take a meta-analysis between them. What are your thoughts about it? And the last one is a bit about Mexican practice. So for the auditorium is probably listening to us. You will sometimes have the fight between radiologists and vascular surgeons in Mexico, even cardiologists, that will do CLTI patients. And you said at the very beginning of the conversation, we need to work as a team. Something you want to discuss about how to work as a multidisciplinary team for CLTI patients?
Yes. Okay. So in terms of the meta-analysis, the investigators of the BESCLI trial have already signed a transfer or data exchange, if you like, agreement with the Basel II core research team. And that means that there's a meta-analysis that will be coming out at some point over the next year and a half or so. That will be an individual patient level meta-analysis, much like the carotid trialists did about 20 years ago. That will be a very interesting paper because that way we'll be able to remove some of that noise that I was talking about, the heterogeneity. At the same time, you know how we discussed about primary outcome measures and power. These studies, both of these in isolation, are well-designed, well-conducted trials. in order to look at the relevant or their respective primary outcome measures. The meta-analysis will definitely be useful for us. Same time, already we've got some excellent evidence out there based on these two trials in order to guide us with our decision making. With regards to working together as teams, I think we need to bite the bullet really and start collaborating in a more productive way. I don't really care what your job title is, as long as you are trained to offer the right procedure for the right patient at the right time. And no one should worry about our job titles, right? I mean, what difference does it make whether you're a radiologist or a cardiologist? The problems start when you're quite passionate about doing certain things that cannot really be done in certain ways in your environment. Why am I talking about? Hybrid revascularizations cannot be done in an angio suite, okay? Sometimes in an operating theater, we don't have the right imaging. So should we be doing complex angioplasties as surgeons with a simple C-arm in an open theater? Probably not. So look at what kind of expertise is available around you, is my take, and try and use that expertise for the right patient at the right time. And don't worry about job titles. I mean, that's futile. Why do we worry about these things? What we really should worry about is the wrong person doing a procedure on a patient. That's what really pisses me off sometimes.
I have a question about this issue, because of course multidisciplinary teams show the best results, yep. But also the late referral of patients also show worst outcomes and higher yep. mortality rates. So should we be training all vascular surgeons into both methods, or should this be only done in centers? I don't know if I'm explaining myself. I mean, like, it's postgraduate education going to change after these results?
Who knows? It's a public health question, really, isn't it? At the moment, there's a lot of data to say that complex procedures on complex patients are associated with much better outcomes in major centers where you've got a variety of expertise. That's for sure. If I had CLTI, I would like to be treated in a center where people have got experience and expertise relating to both open revascularizations as well as complex endovascular procedures. Is that possible on a public health level or a societal level, if you like? It is way too expensive to do that kind of thing. And then you're absolutely right. Some patients might miss their treatment being offered on time because they've got to travel something like 3,000 miles. The geography of the United Kingdom allows this kind of centralization. And in general, the geography of Europe allows that kind of revascularization pattern because you won't have to travel more than 100 miles or so to get to a major center. When you're looking at countries like Mexico or the United States, things are very different. And I'm probably not the right person to answer that question. You probably need a public health expert and a health economist. But what we're seeing here from both of these studies is that you need both, you need expertise that relate to both types of treatment if you are hoping to get the best outcomes for your CLTI patients. And sometimes that might mean that if you're seeing a CLTI patient and you haven't got the appropriate expertise available in your region, you send them elsewhere.
With Thanos?
Well, one of my questions was that if we consider all of known open candidates, all patients with a high surgical risk, and patients that were not included in these trials, like rest pain, or even the patients that just prefer the endovascular approach, is it more true that in the real world, for infrapopliteal segment, endovascular therapy is still dominant?
Okay. Probably yes, but I'm not going to commit myself to that answer. Again, it depends on what kind of expertise you've got available, right? I would say that, let's take this a step back and think about it using common sense. If you've got a wire and you've got a number of balloons and stents, well, you can revascularize all three arteries going to the foot. You can then go into the foot and perform an inframalleolar angioplasty. You can reconstruct the whole arch. You can go into the medial plantar artery, etc. So at least from a common sense point of view, an endovascular approach gives you access to more options. But that's the way that I see it as a not very clever person. Okay. So it's not really surprising that for those with very distal disease, if you're using a treatment that gives you a few more options, you might get better outcomes. Then the second element to my thinking, especially in countries like Mexico, where you mentioned that you've got a bit more access to endovascular expertise through cardiology or IR, interventional radiology, I mean, again, it might be that you'll have better access earlier in the process of CLTI to endovascular procedures. So I guess, yeah, you could argue that endovascular is the future here, at least based on common sense and some of the findings from the Basel II trial.
You mentioned about the retrograde access, and we yeah. have now atherectomy, and we talked in a previous episode about the TAC device. When is it the time to say, okay, enough for the endovascular attempts, and we should stop the case?
Yeah, that depends on your experience with using certain endovascular technologies. If you cannot use some form of atherectomy device safely, then that's enough. You have to stop, okay? And likewise, if you're not very familiar with doing a retrograde procedure, try and find some help and be open-minded because the patient will appreciate it. Gabriel probably knows about this, but I will never do angioplasties these days unless I've prepped the whole leg and foot, because that way my brain is conditioned to thinking about a retrograde procedure if I cannot cross the SFA or a popliteal lesion, etc. What am I trying to say here? With more experience, you somehow morph your brain and you as a surgeon or an interventionalist into someone who's keen to try something slightly more complex in order to get better outcomes. I can't really answer your question in a very clear way, but all of these new technologies, they definitely have got their place. I agree with the people are saying that we need more randomized evidence behind them, absolutely. But at the same time, please just use some common sense in terms of what you can and cannot do when you're using these technologies. And I think many of them are extremely helpful for some patients.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Thanos. Just to conclude, what do you think has been the most important thing through all the process of Basel II, and not only Basel II, because you're also involved in, you know, arteriac RCTs and multiple RCTs. What have you learned through all these RCTs and especially on Basel II during the trial and after publishing?
Yeah, that's very easy to answer. Always doubt yourself. When Best CLI came out, everyone knew the answer. They were so certain that open surgery is the future. Well, is it? You've just got another major trial saying that endovascular procedures might be better for certain patients. And to all of the people that keep doubting about the generation of randomized evidence, what I have learned is that we owe it to our patients to at least inform them about the randomized trials that are ongoing and discuss recruiting them into one of those trials. It's the only way to offer better treatments to the future generations. And take it again, it is our duty to do that. As a doctor, it's not just your duty to save someone's life and foot, etc. It is also your duty to generate the evidence that will guide future generations in order to save lives and save legs.
Thank you. I think that's a beautiful conclusion, and there is not much to add to that comment. So we are reaching our time for the episode, and we want to thank you, Dr. Thanos, for being here and sharing all of your knowledge. I hope you enjoyed the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Very nice talking to you guys. Yeah, hopefully I'll see you again in the near future.
Yes, and I want to thank Gabriel for making this possible. And I don't know if you have something else to say, Gabriel.
No, thank you. Thank you both for this. Thank you very much, Thanos. Really grateful. Yeah, definitely shouldn't be the last time. We can discuss a lot of things about vascular. Yeah. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. I'll just say it in Spanish. Probablemente la mejor conclusión es hacer los tratamientos personalizados para cada paciente. No tenemos muchas herramientas y creo que no es momento para politizar. Ah, yo soy team endovascular, soy team abierto. Creo que cada paciente tiene una estrategia. Como dijo Thanos, hay que individualizar y saber cuándo son nuestros limitantes para pedir ayuda o los equipos multidisciplinarios, ¿no? Que creo que es lo que falta mucho en México, tratando de hacer todo uno solo, ¿no? Como cirujano.
Sí, completamente de acuerdo. Y pues invitar también al trabajo en equipo, a los centros multidisciplinarios, y saber que en México existe la posibilidad de ir haciendo las cosas mejor. Así que la invitación, pues, justamente es este tema que toca Gabriel. Vamos a decidir entonces la mejor estrategia para cada caso, para cada paciente. Y, como siempre, pues, agradecer a todos los angioescuchas haber estado en este espacio, habernos escuchado. Recuerden, agradecemos siempre que nos compartan en redes sociales, en WhatsApp, que nos dejen sus me gustas, que nos dejen sus comentarios y los escuchamos en el próximo episodio. Saludos a todos. Okay.
Good
so
stuff.
Thank you very much.
Right, I can eat now. All right, bye-bye both. Thanks
thank you
again.
Very much, Thanos. See you.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye.